This is Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're talking with Glenn Greenwald. He's the co-founder of the investigative journalism website, The Intercept. A staunch opponent of the growth and abuse of presidential power under George W. Bush and Barack Obama, Greenwald is the most insistent and most consistent critic of government abuses of civil liberties. He's a champion of whistleblowers such as Chelsea Manning, WikiLeaks, and Edward Snowden, whose work he was central to making known to the broader public. In 2014, Greenwald received the Lanny Friedlander Prize from Reason, which is an award that we give to an individual or group who has created a publication, medium, or distribution platform that vastly expands human freedom by increasing our ability to express ourselves, engage in debate, and generate new ways of understanding the power of free minds and free markets. He joins us from his home in Brazil. Glenn Greenwald, thanks for talking to Reason today.
Happy to do it.
So you're critical about most accounts of Russian agents hacking the election. That's kind of an understatement. But did the Senate hearings on the matter yesterday featuring James Clapper, director of national intelligence, change your mind at all?
No, not at all. So just to be clear of what my position is, I certainly don't put it past the Russians to do things like this. Mm-hmm. I would not be surprised, let alone shocked, if it turns out they did do it. This is certainly the sort of thing that both Russia and the U.S. have done to one another and to many other countries for decades. My point is a journalistic one and one of citizenship, which is that we ought not to believe claims, particularly inflammatory claims involving a nuclear armed power, that come from the U.S. government absent convincing evidence that's presented in public. And
so,
there was no convincing evidence presented in public yesterday. It was just more assertions.
Right. What would count and as convincing evidence? And supposedly the public version of the report that Clapper and the CIA and DHS, FBI have put together is going to be made, the redacted version will be made public early next week. But what's the type of evidence that would convince you? That, in fact, this is true.
Yeah, I mean, so there is an inherent difficulty here, which is that attribution is a notoriously difficult thing to pin down. And computer and hacking experts, you know, say that there's all sorts of reasons why you can never really do it with precision. But what I would like to see is the evidence, not just that the Russians did it, mm-hmm. but that the Russian government directed it in a way that a consensus of experts in the field say that this is convincing evidence that units associated with the Russian government actually did the hacking physically, mm-hmm. and that there's evidence to show that it was actually directed by the Kremlin as opposed to just people inside Russia.
Yeah, and I mean, to be kind of follow up on that, okay, so we hear in press reports, you know, 17 agencies all agree within the U.S. government agree that the Russians did this and that it was directed at the highest levels possible, that Putin and all of his henchmen and minions, whatever we want to call them, wanted Trump to win the election. CrowdStrike, and it's turning out that actually the U.S. intelligence agency may not have actually looked at some of the servers that that material was served on, but a private agency, CrowdStrike, did that. I mean, is there really a way that given the bastardized truth claims that the U.S. intelligence community has been making for decades now, would you ever really believe them?
I mean, if evidence were presented publicly, for example, if there were some kind of 9/11 style, commission mm-hmm. that was staffed by credible experts and trustworthy people who conducted a comprehensive investigation and published their findings with as much evidence publicly available as possible, I would be open-minded to believing it. But you're right. The agencies that are in question are ones that are designed to deceive and disseminate disinformation and have a long history of lying repeatedly. And even in a Washington Post article that made huge waves 2 or 3 weeks ago, where they said the CIA concluded that the Russians did this to swing the election to Trump, even buried within that article, it said there is dissent within these agencies, although they called it on minor questions, but we don't know what this dissent is. And it reminds me very much of 2002, when we learned only much later on that the dissent was actually quite significant and was suppressed and ignored and marginalized.
Well, and to follow up on that, what would it matter? I mean, given what has happened here, because what we have are two WikiLeaks dumps of important emails, although perhaps less bombshelly than might have been predicted, but of the DNC and of the Podesta emails. Does that, I mean, because there's no question, you know, there are no real claims that Russian hackers were monkeying around with vote totals on electronic voting machines or anything like that. Would it matter, or in what way would it matter, because that the Russians were trying to screw with an election campaign? You mentioned that the U.S. does this all the time. I mean, we've actually gone much further in places like Honduras and, you know, actively work to change political outcomes. I mean, in within recent memory. So, you know, what for you, what are the stakes of finding out that a foreign power is doing this type of stuff?
Right. So that's the other great question. So let's assume that the Russians really did do this. First of all, it's an extremely crude and primitive operation. We're not talking about some, you know, sophisticated, masterminded invasion of the U.S. cyber network. We're talking about the equivalent of the spam email that you get from a Nigerian saying, wire $100,000 to my bank account so that I can then give you $11 million. It was because John Podesta clicked on a phishing link of the most primitive and crudest kind that whoever hacked these emails was able to obtain them. And then all that it entailed was publishing accurate documents that allowed us to get some insight into the Clinton campaign. So even if the Russians did it, it's hardly some nefarious invasion on the level of an act of war or anything like that. It would be a very primitive and crude thing. And that is the question. Why are Democrats so obsessed with it? It's not because they have some policy that they want to pursue of confrontation with Russia. It's because they want to create this narrative that they didn't lose the election. The election was stolen from them by Vladimir Putin. And it's very self-interested and political and doesn't have much ramifications beyond that, except that ratcheting up tensions between two traditionally hostile superpowers can lead to all kinds of unintended nasty consequences, which is the reason why I think restraint and skepticism are so important.
Well, you know, this raises the question of the concept of fake news, which has led Facebook and other platforms to start talking about or implementing kind of evaluations of news stories and saying this is true or this is not true. You've written recently that the very same people, and I'm quoting from you from a piece at The Intercept, the very same people most vocal about the need to suppress fake news are often the most eager to disseminate it when doing so advances their agenda. And you point to the story in The Washington Post that you mentioned about supposedly Russian agents flooding the market with fake news stories that you know caused the problem. The Washington Post has kind of walked that back. The more recent story about Vermont power utilities or electric companies being infiltrated by Russian hackers also walked back. Is fake news simply a means by which legacy media and even new media forms are reasserting power over the parameters of legitimate discussion?
So the thing that always raises my alarm systems whenever there's some new terminology introduced into the discourse is whenever it's being widely used and all kinds of policies are being demanded on the basis of it, but it remains completely ill-defined. It reminds me a lot of things like hate speech, which is completely in the eye of the beholder, but is used to censor all kinds of ideas and punish people for expressing them. It definitely reminds me of terrorism, which can be applied or not applied based on whatever side of the bed you wake up on any given day. What is fake news? There's almost no definition of it. And so there may be a very kind of narrow set of behaviors that are of a particular marginal concern, you know, sort of Macedonian teenagers purposely creating fake websites that look like news sites. They're really designed to mislead people in order to get clicks. But I still have a hard time distinguishing that between that and, say, the Washington Post, within a period of 6 weeks, producing two stories that had major impact on our discourse, not which were walked back, but which were completely discredited and then ultimately retracted. What is their motive? Is it political? Is it to please their sources? Is it to generate clicks in order to then generate advertising revenue? I think it's a lot of that. And so even if you want to try and distinguish it on in terms of intent, I have a hard time seeing this line as being very clear. And yeah, I think that what this really is about is trying to say that just like the U.S. can't commit terrorism, large media outlets like The Washington Post and The New York Times and NBC News can't create and disseminate fake news, and therefore Facebook should take these alternative outlets that are the challengers or the more marginalized websites and rigorously control their ability to compete with the New York Times and the Washington Post based on this claim that there's this menace of fake news that needs to be confronted and controlled.
So would you draw a sharp distinction, a soft distinction, no distinction between, say, another story that you took to task, which was a Guardian piece that fundamentally misrepresented an interview with Julian Assange of WikiLeaks and claiming that he was giving guarded praise to Donald Trump or guarded support, and that he had a close relationship with Vladimir Putin's regime in Russia. I mean, these were later shown to be total fabrications based on the interview the Guardian was summarizing, and say the Pizzagate story that talked about Comet Pizza as a den of child pedophilia or whatever in Washington D.C. because of kind of Nazi people who extracted weird ideas out of the Podesta emails. I mean, are these the same things, or is one actually more dangerous than the other? I mean, the Pizzagate story led to a guy shooting up the pizza joint in D.C.
The Guardian and the series of stories that the New York Times published in 2002 by Michael Gordon and Judy Miller led to a war that killed many hundreds of thousands of people, if not more than a million. And, I think that, maybe you can draw some kind of line between those, but I'm not sure that that line has been clearly established or clearly defined. You know, it is true that good faith media outlets, even the ones who are following the most rigorous standards of journalism as faithfully as possible, are sometimes going to make mistakes, right? Sometimes you make mistakes because we're humans, and you produce a story that ends up not being true, and you have to amend it or correct it, or in some cases even retract it. So I do think there's a difference between good faith attempts to inform the public that end up resulting in erroneous stories versus, on the other hand, deliberately creating something without any intent whatsoever to inform the public, actually intending to create false stories for whatever political or financial objective you have. The reason why that line breaks down for me is because if you look at the most humiliating journalistic debacles of the last 6 to 9 months, they all involve Russia. And so that starts to look to me a lot like either someone has a political agenda and has thrown all journalistic standards to the wind, or they know that if they feed a hungry public that still is angry about Putin and angry about Clinton's loss, anything at all that hypes this threat of Russia, they're going to get clicks and shares and all kinds of benefits and profit. And so that starts to look to me more like somebody creating a fake news story for their own gain than it does a good faith journalistic effort that just happens to end in error.
So do you think, because this is something that you go back to a lot in your work, that, American reporters tend to be extremely credulous of authority, as much as, the United States media and I guess media in other countries, too, want to say they're the watchdog. You mentioned people like Judy Miller, who clearly was being fed intelligence and did not act on it critically in a way that when you go back and look at the weapons of mass destruction coverage at USA Today and at The Washington Post, they were much more skeptical of these claims. But why do reporters keep being kind of fooled by intelligence sources that are obviously politically interested in advancing a particular point of view? Is it an access game? Is it with regards to Russia? Is it that many of us have not really broken from a Cold War mindset where, I'm sure you have conversations like this too, where you're talking with people about contemporary Russia and they start mentioning, or, they'll use the word the Soviet Union, in place of Russia without even thinking about it. Is it that larger kind of mindset that is difficult to break out of, or is it credulity, or is it a bid to maintain access to powerful sources?
So I think it's a lot. I think it's a combination of all of those things, and I would add one more. So look at the story, the most absurd story of the Washington Post saying that Vladimir Putin had invaded the U.S. electric grid through a Vermont utility. They got the governor of Vermont and Pat Leahy to say this thug Putin is trying to steal the heat from Vermonters during the dead of winter to make them suffer. I mean, it's like a cartoon, right? It's a joke. So how did the Post fall for this? And what happened there was two intelligence officials came to the Post and told the reporters who work on the intelligence beat that this happened. They made no attempt to verify it. They didn't contact the utility companies. They didn't want any evidence. They expressed no skepticism in the article. They went and they just made it the most sensationalistic report possible. Why? First of all, that means in the future, these intelligence sources know that whatever information they want to disseminate to the public, they go to that reporter. And that's very beneficial for that reporter because now this reporter gets scoops. He gets exclusives. He gets the kind of platform that a story like this gets. He gets a lot of traffic. He gets to go on TV shows. He looks like he's a really important reporter because he's pleased the people who can actually give him scoops. On top of that, I think that there is absolutely this kind of bubble that these reporters live in. They live in Washington, they live in New York, and they adopt the prevailing ethos. And the prevailing ethos is Russia is the grave threat. Putin is the current villain. You know, 3 years ago, the big villain was Ahmadinejad in Iran. Before that, it was Gaddafi. Before that, it was Saddam Hussein. It was Osama bin Laden. We always have some kind of script that tells us there's some huge villain that we all have to hate. And the current one is Putin. And they get they're linked into this culturally and politically. And so absolutely, they view it through this sort of elite political prism, and they believe they're doing the right thing. But the final point that I think is also important is the way in it's so important. There's this new dynamic where journalists now sit on the same venue with one another all day long, which is Twitter. They're constantly monitoring how they're being judged and assessed by their peers. There's immediate feedback to whatever they do. So if they publish something that their peers dislike, they get attacked and they get denounced and they get condemned, which nobody likes. And if they do something that is popular, they get rewarded and pleased and retweeted and their social media following grows. It is, I think, the most powerful tool of generating groupthink that I've seen in my lifetime. And there's nothing worse in journalism than groupthink, because journalists ought to be the ones pushing back against orthodoxies and conventions and challenging groupthink, not trying to swim in the same stream as it. And so I think that if you go on Twitter, just you can do your own experiment and you post something that says Putin is evil, Putin is lurking behind, you know, this world problem, everyone will retweet you, everyone will praise you, everyone will give you all sorts of benefits. And if you challenge it, you'll get attacked. And I think that creates a really heavy incentive scheme for journalists to just bolster the prevailing orthodoxy rather than to challenge it.
So what are the ways around that? Because in a way, obviously, I mean, your work is dedicated to doing that, of you know, seeking truth as you understand it and correcting the record and pushing back against a status quo or a kind of general narrative if it's seen as erroneous. But you know, a lot of what you're talking about seems to suggest that really ultimately only some new form of media literacy on the part of the reader is really ultimately the bulwark against this kind of stuff. What are either the strategies or the mentalities or the interventions that need to happen to make sure that in this new age of kind of groupthink in major media that we don't, after a brief moment of liberation where, you know, you're publishing on a platform that didn't exist even a few years ago. Reason, I know, as a, you know, as a think magazine, with the rise of the internet and the World Wide Web, we were able to reach a much vaster audience. It's very liberating for us, but you know, it gets swallowed up in other things. What's the right approach to media literacy for conventional readers as well as other journalists?
Well, it's so interesting because it gets back to the question about fake news that you asked me earlier. I mean, why are people willing to believe stories from websites that they've never heard of before, in not just as faithfully, but in a lot of cases more faithfully than stories that they get from the New York Times or the Washington Post? And the reason is because the credibility of the New York Times and major media institutions in the eyes of a huge percentage of the population has collapsed. And the reason it's collapsed is because of things like the 2002 lead up to the Iraq War, or what happened in 2008 with the financial crisis, or the perception that they're willing to print anything like Russia invaded our electric grid, even if it turns out to be false, because of the benefits that they get. And when you add on to that, you're right, the internet has empowered a lot of alternative news organizations. Reason has reached a much bigger audience. Mm-hmm. We were able to create a new website that reaches a big audience in a very short period of time. So of a lot of other people, that's great. It produces competition and a diversity of voices. But the flip side to it is that you can, and a lot of people do, create their own worlds of information where the only information they're willing to be open to is information that comes from places that feed them what they want to hear, that bolster and affirm their ideology, or that they have decided are trustworthy because those places flatter their viewpoints. And I think one of the biggest challenges for journalists generally, or for any kind of entity that's concerned about this fake news phenomenon and the way we've balkanized ourselves on the internet and elsewhere, is to demonstrate that you actually have credibility across factional lines, across ideological and partisan divides, that you're willing to be a reliable and trustworthy source of information rather than just some hack that's serving or pleasing or having allegiance to a particular faction. And that's why I think, you know, the kind of pushback I do against journalism is something I'm so passionate about, because I do actually think it's important that we have institutions that are trustworthy and trusted to disseminate information, so we all have a basic set of facts that we're working with. And I think the media has played a big role in the collapse of that authority and the collapse of that credibility because of the behaviors we've been discussing.
What do you think, in those terms, what do you think of Julian Assange, and what do you think of, you know, as an individual? And I know you've written that Julian Assange matters less than WikiLeaks, but do you think Julian Assange is helping the cause of a kind of forced transparency? Or does he get in the way as a personality?
You know, I guess the way that I would say this is that WikiLeaks set itself up as a force that exists very much outside of mainstream institutions, and not just outside of it, but adversarial to it. It mm-hmm. wanted to be a kind of opponent, an adversary, maybe even an enemy of prevailing American political and media institutions and institutions in the West generally. And people who do that, who decide that they want to do that, generally have a certain kind of personality. And that personality tends to be anti-authoritarian, very kind of individualistic, often very confrontational and combative. People who do that tend to have difficult personalities. When you add on to that already existent kind of personality type that you almost always need for an institution like that to be created successfully, being attacked by governments all over the world, having it openly debated whether or not you should be imprisoned or killed, and then most recently taking the person and putting them into a tiny little room that they're stuck in and have not left for 5 years, including even just being able to go outside and see the light of day. He's now been in the Ecuadorian embassy for the last 5 years. Whatever difficult personality attributes already exist, I think are going to be severely exacerbated. It is amazing that under these conditions, he's still able to have the extraordinary effect that he has had. But, you know, I think that there are a lot of people in public life with very difficult personality types, but I think that his tend to get focused on more than other people's, precisely because he's now an enemy of so many people who have the loudest megaphones.
Do you have any questions? I mean, you have at various points, I mean, both celebrated WikiLeaks and its effect on kind of disseminating information that wouldn't have been found elsewhere or wouldn't been discussed elsewhere, but it also criticizing it for kind of unredacted data dumps. Where are you in that kind of spectrum now?
Yeah, I mean, I've been a supporter of WikiLeaks for a long time and still do view them on balance as a force for good. But we definitely have very significant differences. They were very critical of the way that we reported on the Snowden archive, both privately and publicly, because they were angry that we didn't just take the entire archive and dump the whole thing onto the internet without regard to the consequences that doing that would have, including destroying the privacy and reputation of lots of innocent people, which is what would happen if we just dumped the whole archive. We had a source who insisted that we treat that archive responsibly and report it story by story and protect the interest of innocent people, which I think is the moral thing to do. I think it's the ethical thing to do, and I think it's the journalistically responsible thing to do. WikiLeaks has a different view, which is that nothing should ever be withheld. Everything should be dumped on the internet. If you get John Podesta's inbox, you don't go through it for things in the public interest. You dump it all, including stuff that is him talking to his wife about intimate and personal issues. You do it without regard to the effect that you're having on people's privacy. I think that's a big mistake that WikiLeaks has made. It's not something that I would want to participate in doing. But nonetheless, I want to, you know, be clear that on balance, I think that their transparency project and the way they've pioneered the idea of transparency in the digital age is still something that should be supported and is a positive. I just think that they make a big mistake by taking this absolutist position that all information, regardless of consequence, should be disseminated.
So if you had gotten the Podesta emails, you would have gone through them and taken, you would have only released things that you believed were truly in the public interest. What about something like the Sony hack? Would that have risen to your level of public scrutiny, or how do you decide, and I realize, you know, a lot of it's going to be case by case, but what is in the public interest and what should be kept private in an age of kind of horrifying transparency?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, something that is intrinsic to journalism. Every journalist makes exactly that judgment call every single day when they get information. You ask yourself, is this information that I've now obtained enough in the public interest to justify my publishing it? And on some level, every act of journalism is an invasion of privacy, because every act of journalism entails publishing information that shines a light on somebody or some entity that they would prefer not to be revealed. And you're constantly weighing that. So, you know, I think that the more powerful an actor is, certainly the more public power they wield, but even private corporate power, Sony has a huge impact on a lot of people's lives. They have a lot of relationships with the government. I think that the greater transparency they deserve. But I think that everybody, even the most powerful, retains some level of privacy, and that information about them that's not in the public interest, meaning that doesn't inform a debate, that doesn't affect an issue of legitimate public concern, that kind of information should not be publicized.
We are a couple weeks out from Donald Trump, of all people, becoming president of the United States. You have been extremely critical of Hillary Clinton over the years. Did you vote in the election, and who did you vote for, if you did?
Yeah, so I mean, I try not to define myself publicly by attaching myself to political candidates.
Okay.
You know, or to have my work viewed through that prism. So I just try, and I also don't like sort of being this, you know, contrived voice of authority where I tell people who to vote for or who they should vote for. I try and just restrict my work to disseminating information that I think will enable other people to make those choices.
But
I will say,
yes,
having said all that, that I was extremely open about the fact that I thought that Donald Trump, was just, in terms of his persona, in terms of his psyche, in terms of his instability, an extremely dangerous person to allow anywhere near the White House. I was pretty clear about that.
So, and also not to try to equalize them, but also Hillary would have been dangerous in a different set of ways.
Absolutely.
So thinking about Trump taking over the White House, what are the worst dimensions of executive power that Obama beefed up that you worry the most about Donald Trump now? You know, however much Obama has swollen executive power, it's now Trump's to take. What are the things that worry you the most about that?
Well, I would begin with the unlimited system of mass surveillance that has been constructed during the war on terror, but strongly accelerated during the 8 years that Obama has been president, that allows not just the NSA, but various agencies of the executive branch, including the FBI, to access virtually any kind of information that it wants about not just foreign nationals, but also American citizens. Obama has consecrated the right of the U.S. government and explicitly advocated it and, in fact, implemented the power to target even U.S. citizens on foreign soil for assassination without trial or charges of any kind, as they did with Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born imam in Yemen, and created a theory that even U.S. citizenship does not shield you from being killed by your own government without the right to have due process in court, something that was probably one of the leading concerns of the founders of the country not to allow to happen. They were petrified of the idea that you could even be searched and had, you know, searched or imprisoned without due process, let alone killed without due process. And then probably most of all, the ability to just simply wage wars anywhere in the world without any kind of public debate or congressional authorization. The country that Obama has bombed the most in 2016 is Syria. Hmm. There is no congressional authorization for Obama to engage in military action in Syria. There was no public debate about whether that should be happen. The only public debate that took place was in 2013 when they wanted to remove Assad, and the public said no, Congress said no, and then they didn't do it. But they've continued to wage virtually full-scale war in Syria because that power has now been vested in the modern presidency, and that's a power that Donald Trump will also inherit.
Do you worry at all? I mean, these are civil libertarian concerns kind of constitutional concerns that I think should worry everybody, and they do worry a lot of people, and hopefully many liberals who were kind of silent on the expansion of Obama's expansion of those powers, which he was building off of what George Bush had done and presidents before that. What about things like economic rights? I mean, or economic regulation and executive power? Is that dangerous as well? Do you worry about something like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is an agency that has broad powers to punish people and businesses, that was mostly done through kind of executive edict? Do those types of concerns and expansions of executive power worry you?
Yes, and the reason is this, which is there's this kind of long-standing debate about economics between the right and the left, economic policy that I think has become obsolete. And that debate used to always be, sort of the Reagan era, going back to the 50s, what is the proper level of government intervention in the free market? And the right wanted as little as possible. Certainly the libertarian right wanted as little as possible, lower taxes, abolish regulation, let the market handle everything. And on the left, there was obviously a much greater desire for much further government intervention in the marketplace in order to help the poor with social programs, to impose regulations to safeguard people's health and safety and all of that. The reason why I think that debate has become obsolete is because typically when the government goes to intervene in the market, it isn't to help the poor. It's to help the rich. It's not capitalism in the way that the right has always supported it and the left has opposed it. It's crony capitalism. It's a merger between corporate and political power. And so the more intervention that the government does into the economic market, the more this kind of alliance gets strengthened. I think that's why you see in a lot of ways when even on economic policy now, things like auditing the Fed and digging into that relationship is something that's supported on both the left and the right, or bailing out Wall Street, which was the opposition to which spawned both Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party. Right. A lot of these right-left divisions have broken down because it's not really capitalism in that sense, but crony capitalism that we're talking about. And so I do worry about that being strengthened.
Do you worry about, I know you're a proponent of, or are you a proponent of single payer health plans? You were very critical of the way that Obamacare came out. And you, I believe, wrote that, this was actually the bill that Obama wanted and that it included a lot of kind of sweetheart deals to big pharma to get them to come on, insurance companies to come on, et cetera. Do you worry not only the intersection of kind of economic power and political power to help established interests, but, the mass collection of medical data? If you did have a full single-payer healthcare system, that becomes this vast reservoir of very intimate, very personal data that would be at the behest of a government that has shown a willingness to surveil people or to use information against them. Does that worry you at all?
Yeah, it worries me anytime the government or any entity, including private corporations,
right,
are able to collect huge amounts of data on people. But let me just pick up on that, because that healthcare question goes back to exactly what I said before, which was the whole healthcare debate began based on the premise that these health that these health insurance giants were nefarious and they were evil in the way they conducted business. And the solution to this problem was to implement a government program that required people, whether they wanted to or not, to buy the products from those very same companies. And that was what was so bizarre about that debate was I would have thought that even, you know, a libertarian kind of perspective would have said it would be better if you're going to have a program like this to have a public option so that people aren't forced to go into the arms of these private companies. I mean, what is more coercive than forcing people to buy private health insurance, whether they want that health insurance policy or not? And that was an example of what got depicted as a classical liberal social program that in fact strengthened and bolstered and put huge amounts of money into the pocket of private industry. And that's what I found so alarming about it, beyond creating centralized entities that then collect very sensitive data about people.
Yeah, I think libertarians would say, and I of course will not speak for any other than myself, but the only thing worse than being forced to buy private insurance would have been being forced to buy public insurance on top of it, but
right, it's an option,
yeah,
right?
No,
it's called a public option, so you have your choice.
Right,
more choice is always better.
Do you? I mean, you spend time in Brazil. Do you do your? What is the attraction to Brazil, which is in many ways an authoritarian country? Is it? Is it that you're not Brazilian, so that you are kind of more of a free agent there, or? How do you choose where to live, where you can, I'm rambling here, but you know, where does your individual freedom flourish the most? Is it being in two countries or being able to move in and out of places?
So the reason I'm in Brazil originally was because when I met my Brazilian husband, the U.S. government had this law in place that barred us from getting immigration rights because there was a prohibition on recognizing our spousal relationship, whereas ironically Brazil, the largest Catholic country in the world, provided immigration rights to same-sex couples. So that's why we originally stayed here. Even once that law has been removed, we have a life here. My husband just got elected to public office here. It's a beautiful country, and authoritarian, I'm not sure that I would accept that characterization.
Okay.
There's actually a lot of civic freedoms in Brazil. There's a lot that are lacking as well. But on the sort of freedom tyranny continuum, it's much closer to the freedom pole than it is to the tyranny pole. But I would just say, you know, there's trade-offs to living anywhere. And my choice to live here is more personal than political.
What do you do? You are very intense in your writings. You're very driven. I mean, you're prolific as hell, and in deep ways. Your Twitter feed is great, and I would recommend everybody follow you, but also the longer pieces you do in the books. What do you do to escape politics? Because I suspect where we would differ on various kinds of policies, we both agree that if politics is the limit of your human experience, you're just missing out on most of what makes living endurable. What do you do in a beyond politics space that that enriches your life?
Well, I am a very fanatical animal rights person, and particularly dogs. We now have 19 dogs who live with us in our house. We do a ton
I think
of
we
dog
heard
rescue.
Some of them in the background.
You heard
earlier.
A little bit yes. of them in the background. I live in the middle of the Rio de Janeiro jungle. So there are monkeys at our house, just constantly around nature and wildlife and animals as a kind of different form of being and thinking. I do a lot of physical exercise. I am a pretty big enthusiast of yoga, which is kind of a window into the spiritual world. And I think you're absolutely right. If I think it's really important, you know, no matter who you are and sort of what your principal passion is, that you find some way of balancing it with things that are completely different and that give expression to other parts of your humanity. Because if you do get too monomaniacally obsessed on any one thing, you do get out of balance. And I think it's unhealthy no matter what that is.
Well, and I'll end with a question about politics, just when you thought you were out and going to go frolic with dogs and swing from vines with monkeys in the jungle. There is a group of libertarian-leaning or libertarian-ish Republicans in the Senate and in Congress. I'm thinking of people like Mike Lee of Utah, Rand Paul, Jeff Flake, Justin Austin Amash, Thomas Massey. Lee, in particular, who's a practicing Mormon and a very serious religious person. He's socially conservative in most of his views in a way that I don't quite find convincing, or I don't agree with. But he's pushing the idea of what he calls the Article One Project, that Congress is actually the first among equals in the branches of government, and that Congress really needs to pull back power from the executive branch and also from the judiciary. Do you think that that's do you think that he's being actually principled there, that this is not simply a way of masking partisanship as principle after 8 years of Obama? But assuming that it is, do you think that that is a way forward that we can be optimistic about? Or how does one get Congress to actually assert its authority and to do things through the processes for creating laws and budgets and all of that in American life?
Yeah, I mean, I actually am excited by things like that because, Donald Trump is going to be president. That's an inevitability. There's no changing that. So you might as well look for silver linings. And I do think that one of the silver linings is that people are searching desperately for ways to limit his power, and not just the standard partisan carousel where a Republican gets to be president and Democrats are suddenly interested in limiting power and vice versa. But there are a lot of Republicans, a lot of independents, a lot of people on the libertarian spectrum, and then of course Democrats and liberals who want to limit Donald Trump's power in a lot of different ways. And so rediscovering common values of the constitutional framework, whether it's Article One or the 10th Amendment or just the Bill of Rights, or just the concept of checks and balances, I think that the only real limitation on what Trump might be able to do is not going to be courts and not going to be just Congress operating on itself. I think it's going to be some kind of popular movement that has to transcend partisanship and ideology. And I think, unlike, say, tax policy or healthcare policy or inheritance taxes, things that liberals and Republicans and conservatives have been arguing about for decades and aren't going to agree on, these kinds of values about how the government should function, how political power should be dispersed and limited, I think the Trump presidency offers a real opportunity to galvanize coalitions around that, that can not just limit Trump, but can start to pull back on some of the excesses of how government power has been functioning since probably really the end of World War II, exacerbated by the war on terror. And that's the sort of thing that I actually do get excited by when I think about the Trump presidency.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking with Glenn Greenwald. He's the co-founder of The Intercept, the author of many books, with one of the most lively Twitter feeds imaginable. Glenn, thanks for talking to Reason.
All right, Nick. Great talking to you. Thanks.
This has been the Reason Podcast, and I'm Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.